"Do I get to be a soldier?" he asked the man. "Sure, now stay close to me. We're going to find a way into the kitchen." Warner had to move slowly, leaning all his weight on the iron rod. They picked their way into the kitchen, where pockets of fire still burned voraciously. Warner realized that what was a fire was the remains of the food pantry. Dozens of cans had exploded and the burned mess clung to the walls. Everything was gone. Powdered milk, eggs, bacon, and ham, everything. But there was still the emergency food storeroom, Warner knew, and his guts tightened at the thought that they could have been trapped down here in the dark without food or water. Utensils were scattered everywhere, blown out of the kitchen equipment pantry by the shock. Warner uncovered a meat cleaver with the tip of his makeshift cane. The blade was serrated. "Get that," he told the boy, and Roland picked it up. They left the kitchen and cafeteria, and Warner led Roland to the ruins of the town square. Slabs of stone had crashed from above, and the entire area was off balance and riddled with deep cracks. The video arcade was still burning, the air dense with smoke. "Here," Warner said, motioning with his light toward the infirmary. They went inside, finding most of the equipment smashed and useless, but Warner kept searching until he discovered a box of tourniquets and a plastic bottle of rubbing alcohol. He told Roland to take one of the tourniquets and the bottle, and then he picked through the shattered drug cabinet. Pills and capsules crunched underfoot like popcorn. Warner's light fell upon the dead face of one of the nurses, crushed by a piece of rock the size of an anvil. There was no sign of Dr. Lang, Earth House's resident physician. Warner's cane uncovered unbroken vials of Demerol and Percodan, and these he asked Roland to pick up for him. Warner stuffed them in his pockets to take back to the colonel. "You still with me?" Warner asked. "Yes, sir." "I'll wake up in a few minutes," Roland thought. "It'll be a Saturday morning, and I'll get out of bed and turn on the computer." "We've got a long way to go," Warner told him. "We'll have to crawl part of the way, but stay with me, understand?" Roland followed him out of the infirmary. He wanted to go back to search for his parents, but he knew that the king needed him more. He was a king's knight, and to be needed like this by the king was a high honor. Again, one part of him recoiled at the horror and destruction that lay around him and shouted, "Wake up! Wake up!" in the whining voice of an anxious schoolboy. But the other part, that was getting stronger, looked around at the bodies exposed in the flashlight beam and knew that the weak had to die so the strong might live. They moved into the corridors, stepping over bodies and ignoring the cries of the wounded. Roland didn't know how long it took them to reach the wrecked control room. He looked at his wristwatch by the light of a burning heap of rubble, but the crystal had cracked, and time had stopped at 10:36. Warner crawled uphill to the edge of the pit and shone his light down. "Colonel," he called, "I've brought help. We're going to get you out." 10 feet below, Macklin stirred and turned his sweating face toward the light. "Hurry," he rasped, and then he closed his eyes again. Roland crawled to the pit's rim. He saw two bodies down there, one lying on top of the other, jammed in a space the size of a coffin. The body on the bottom was breathing, and his hand disappeared into a fissure in the wall. Suddenly, Roland knew what the meat cleaver was for. He looked at the weapon, could see his face reflected in the blade by the spill of light, except it was a distorted face, and not the one he remembered. His eyes were wild and shiny, and blood had crusted into a star-shaped pattern on his forehead. His entire face was mottled with bruises and swollen like a toad frog's, and he looked even worse than the day Mike Armbruster had beaten his ass for not letting him cheat off Roland's paper during a chemistry test. "Little queer, little four-eyed queer," Armbruster had raged, and everyone who ringed them laughed and jeered as Roland tried to escape but was knocked to the dirt again and again. Roland had started to sob, huddled on the ground, and Armbruster had bent down and spat in his face. Do you know how to tie a tourniquet? The hunchback with the eye patch asked him. Roland shook his head. I'll guide you through it when you get down there. He shone his light around and saw several things that would make a good hot fire. The pieces of a desk, the chairs, the clothes off the corpses. They could get the fire started with the burning rubble they'd passed in the corridor, and Warner still had his lighter in his pocket. Do you know what's got to be done?
I think so, Roland replied.
Okay. Now pay attention to me. I can't squeeze down into that hole after him. You can. You're going to draw that tourniquet tight around his arm, and then I'm going to pass down the alcohol. Splash it all over his wrist. He'll be ready when you are. His wrist is probably smashed, so it won't be too hard to get the cleaver through the bones. Now listen to me, Roland. I don't want you hacking down there for a fucking 5 minutes. Do it hard and quick and get it over with. And once you start, don't you even think about stopping before it's done. Do you hear me?
Yes, sir,
Roland answered, and he thought, wake up. I've got to wake up. If you've tied the tourniquet right, you'll have time to seal the wound before it starts bleeding. You'll have something to burn the stump with, and you make sure you set fire to it, hear me? If you don't, he'll bleed to death. The way he's jammed in down there, he won't fight you much, and anyway, he knows what has to be done. Look at me, Roland. Roland looked into the light. If you do what you're supposed to do, Colonel Macklin will live. If you fuck up, he'll die. Pure and simple. Got it? Roland nodded. His head was dizzy, but his heart was pounding. The king's trapped, he thought, and of all the king's knights, I'm the only one who can set him free. But no, no. This wasn't a game. This was real life, and his mother and father were lying up there somewhere. An Earth house had been nuked. The whole country had been nuked. Everything was destroyed. He put a hand to his bloody forehead and squeezed until the bad thoughts were gone. King's Knight. Sir Roland is my name. And now he was about to go down into the deepest, darkest dungeon to save the king, armed with fire and steel. Teddy Bear Warner crawled away to get a fire built, and Roland followed him like an automaton. They piled the pieces of the desk, the chairs, and the clothes from the corpses into a corner and used some burning pieces of cable from the hallway to start the fire. Teddy Bear, moving slowly and in agony, piled on ceiling tiles and added some of the alcohol to the flames. At first, there was just a lot of smoke, but then the red glow began to strengthen. Corporal Prados still sat against the opposite wall watching them work. His face was damp with sweat, and he kept babbling feverishly, but Warner paid him no attention. Now the pieces of desk and the chairs were charring, the bitter smoke rising up into the holes and cracks in the ceiling. Warner hobbled to the edge of the fire and picked up a leg of one of the broken chairs. The other end of it was burning brightly, and the wood had turned from black to ash gray. He poked it back into the bonfire and turned toward Roland. Okay, he said. Let's get it done. Though he ground his teeth with a pressure that wrenched his back, Warner grasped Roland's hand and helped lower him into the pit. Roland stepped on the dead body. Warner kept the light directed at Macklin's trapped arm and talked Roland through the application of the tourniquet to the colonel's wrist. Roland had to lie in a contorted position on the corpse to reach the injured arm, and he saw that Macklin's wrist had turned black. Macklin suddenly shifted and tried to look up, but he couldn't lift his head.
Tighter, Macklin managed to say. Tie knots in the bastard.
It took Roland 4 tries to get it tight enough. Warner dropped the bottle of alcohol down, and Roland splashed the blackened wrist. Macklin took the bottle with his free hand and finally twisted his head up to look at Roland.
What's your name?
Roland Croninger, sir.
Macklin could tell it was a boy from the weight and the voice, but he couldn't make out the face. Something glinted, and he angled his head to look at the meat cleaver the boy held.
Roland, he said, you and I are going to get to know each other real well in the next couple of minutes. Teddy, where's the fire?
Warner's light vanished for a minute, and Roland was alone in the dark with the colonel.
Bad day, Macklin said. Haven't seen any worse. Have you?
No, sir.
Roland's voice shook. The light returned. Warner was holding the burning chair leg like a torch.
I've got it, Colonel. Roland, I'm going to drop this down to you. Ready?
Roland caught the torch and leaned over Colonel Macklin again. The colonel, his eyes hazy with pain, saw the boy's face in the flickering light and thought he recognized him from somewhere.
Where are your parents, son? He asked.
I don't know. I've lost them.
Macklin watched the burning end of the chair leg and prayed that it would be hot enough to do the job.
You'll be okay, he said. I'll make sure of that.
His gaze moved from the torch and fixed on the meat cleaver's blade. The boy crouched awkwardly over him, straddling the corpse, and stared at Macklin's wrist where it had joined the rock wall.
Well, Macklin said, it's time. Okay, Roland. Let's get it done before one of us turns chicken shit. I'm going to try to hang on as much as I can. You ready?
He's ready,
Teddy Bear Warner said from the lip of the pit. Macklin smiled grimly, and a bead of sweat ran down the bridge of his nose.
Make the first lick a hummer, Roland, he urged.
Roland gripped the torch in his left hand and raised his right with the meat cleaver in it back over his head. He knew exactly where he was going to strike, right where the blackened skin was swallowed up in the fissure.
Do it, he told himself. Do it now.
He heard Macklin draw a sharp breath. Roland's hand clenched the cleaver, and it hung at the zenith over his head.
Do it now.
He felt his arm go as rigid as an iron rod.
Do it now.
And he sucked in his breath and brought the cleaver down with all of his strength on Colonel Macklin's wrist. Bone crunched. Macklin jerked, but made no sound. Roland thought the blade had gone all the way through, but he saw with renewed shock that it had only penetrated the man's thick wrist to the depth of an inch.
Finish it!
Warner shouted. Roland pulled the cleaver out. Macklin's eyes, ringed with purple, fluttered closed and then jerked open again.
Finish it,
he whispered. Roland lifted his arm and struck down again. Still the wrist wouldn't part. Roland struck down a third time and a fourth, harder and harder. He heard the one-eyed hunchback shouting at him to hurry, but Macklin remained silent. Roland pulled the cleaver free and struck a fifth time. There was a lot of blood now, but still the tendons hung together. Roland began to grind the cleaver back and forth. Macklin's face had turned a pasty yellow white, his lips as gray as graveyard dirt. It had to be finished before the blood started bursting out like a fire hose. When that happened, Roland knew the king would die. He lifted the cleaver over his head, his shoulder throbbing with the effort, and suddenly, it was not a meat cleaver anymore. It was a holy axe, and he was Sir Roland of the Realm, summoned to free the trapped king from his suffocating dungeon. He was the only one in all the kingdom who could do it, and this moment was his. Righteous power pulsed within him, and as he brought the holy axe flashing down, he heard himself shout in a hoarse, almost inhuman voice. The last of the bone cracked. Sinews parted under the power of the holy axe, and then the king was writhing, and a grotesque bleeding thing with a surface like a sponge was thrust up into Roland's face. Blood sprayed over his cheeks and forehead, all but blinding him.
Burn it!
Warner yelled. Roland put the torch to the bleeding spongy thing. It jerked away from him, but Roland grabbed and held it while Macklin thrashed wildly. He pressed the torch to the wound where the colonel's hand had been. Roland watched the stump burn with dreadful fascination, saw the wound blacken and pucker, heard the hiss of Macklin's burning blood. Macklin's body was fighting involuntarily. The colonel's eyes rolled back in his head, but Roland hung on to the wounded arm. He smelled blood and burnt flesh, drew it deeply into his lungs like a soul-cleansing incense, and kept searing the wound, pressing fire to flesh. Finally, Macklin stopped fighting, and from his mouth came a low, eerie moan, as if from the throat of a wounded beast.
"Okay," Warner called down. "That's it."
Roland was hypnotized by the sight of the melting flesh. The torn sleeve on Macklin's jacket was on fire, and smoke whirled around the walls of the pit.
"That's enough!" Warner shouted.
The boy wouldn't stop.
"Roland, that's enough, damn it!"
This time the man's voice jolted him back to reality. Roland released the colonel's arm and saw that the stump had been burned black and shiny, as if coated with tar. The flames on Macklin's jacket sleeve were gnawing themselves out.
"It's over," Roland realized. "All over."
He beat the piece of wood against the pit's wall until the fire was out, and then he dropped it.
"I'm going to try to find some rope to get you out with," Warner called. "You okay?"
Roland didn't feel like answering. Warner's light moved away, and Roland was left in darkness. He could hear the colonel's harsh breathing, and he crawled backward over the corpse that lay jammed between them until his back was against rock. Then he drew his legs up and clutched the holy axe close to his body. A grin was fixed on his blood-flecked face, but his eyes were circles of shock. The colonel moaned and muttered something that Roland couldn't understand. Then he said it again, his voice tight with pain.
"Shape up." A pause, then again. "Shape up. Shape up, soldier."
The voice was delirious, getting louder and then fading to a whisper.
"Shape up.
Yes, sir. Every bit of it. Yes, sir. Yes, sir."
Colonel Macklin's voice began to sound like a child, cringing from a whipping.
"Yes, sir, please. Yes, sir. Yes, sir."
He ended with a sound that was half moan, half shuddering sob. Roland had been listening carefully. That had not been the voice of a triumphant war hero. It had sounded more like a cringing supplicant. And Roland wondered what lived inside the king's mind. A king shouldn't beg, he thought, not even in his worst nightmares. It was dangerous for a king to show weakness. Later, how much later, Roland didn't know, something prodded his knee. He groped in the dark and touched an arm. Macklin had gained consciousness.
"I owe you," Colonel Macklin said.
And now he sounded like the tough war hero again. Roland didn't reply, but it had dawned on him that he was going to need protection to survive whatever was ahead. His father and mother might be dead, probably were, and their bodies lost forever. He was going to need a shield from the dangers of the future, not only within Earth House but beyond it. That is, he told himself, if they ever saw the outside world again. But he planned on staying close to the king from now on. It might be the only way that he could get out of these dungeons alive. And, if anything, he wanted to live to see what remained of the world beyond Earth House. One day at a time, he thought, and if he'd lived through the first day, he could make it through the second and the third. He'd always been a survivor. That was part of being a king's knight. And now he'd do whatever it took to keep himself alive. The old game's over, he thought. The new game's about to begin, and it might be the greatest game of King's Knight he'd ever experienced, because it was going to be real. Roland cradled the holy axe and waited for the one-eyed hunchback to return, and he imagined he heard the sound of dice rattling in a cup of bleached bone.
Chapter 16.
"Lady, I sure as hell wouldn't drink that if I was you."
Startled by the voice, Sister Creep looked up from the puddle of black water she'd been crouching over. Standing a few yards away was a short, rotund man wearing the tattered, burned rags of a mink coat. Beneath the rags were red silk pajamas. His bird-like legs were bare, but he had a pair of black wingtips on his feet. His round, pale moon of a face was cratered with burns, and all his hair had been scorched away except for his gray sideburns and eyebrows. His face was badly swollen, his large nose and jowls ballooned up as if he were holding his breath, and the blue threads of broken blood vessels were showing. In the slits of his eye sockets, his dark brown eyes moved from Sister Creep's face to the puddle of water and back again. "That shit's poison," he said, pronouncing it pison. "Kill you right off." Sister Creep stayed crouched over the puddle like a beast protecting a water hole. She'd found shelter from the pouring rain in the hulk of a taxi and had tried to sleep there through the long and miserable night. But her few minutes of rest had been disturbed by hallucinations of the thing with a melting face in the theater. As soon as the black sky had lightened to the color of river mud, she'd left her shelter, trying very hard not to look at the corpse in the front seat, and gone in search of food and water. The rain had slowed to an occasional drizzle of needles, but the air was getting colder. The chill felt like early November, and she was shivering in her drenched rags. The puddle of rainwater beneath her face smelled like ashes and brimstone, but she was so dried out and thirsty that she'd been about to plunge her face in and open her mouth.
"Busted water main shooting up a geyser back that way," the man said, and he motioned toward what Sister Creep thought was north. "Looks like Old Faithful."
She leaned back from the contaminated puddle. Thunder growled in the distance like a passing freight train, and there was no way to see the sun through the low, muddy clouds.
"You find anything to eat?" she asked him through swollen lips. "A couple of onion rolls in what was a bakery, I guess. Couldn't keep 'em down, though. My wife says I'm the world's champion upchucker."
He put a blistered hand on his belly.
"Got ulcers and a nervous stomach."
Sister Creep stood up. She was about 3 inches taller than he.
"I'm thirsty," she said. "Will you take me to the water?"
He looked up at the sky, cocking his head toward the sound of thunder, then stood dumbly regarding the ruins around them.
"I'm trying to find a phone or a policeman," he said. "I've been looking all night. Can't find either one when you need 'em, right?"
"Something terrible's happened," Sister Creep told him. "I don't think there are any phones or cops anymore."
"I gotta find a phone," the man said urgently. "See, my wife's gonna wonder what happened to me. I gotta call her and let her know I'm okay."
His voice trailed off, and he stared at a pair of legs that protruded stiffly from a pile of twisted iron and concrete slabs.
"Oh,"
he whispered, and Sister Creep saw his eyes glaze over like fog on window glass. "He's crazy as hell," she thought, and she started walking north, climbing up a high ridge of rubble. In a few minutes, she heard the fat little man breathing heavily as he caught up with her.
"See," he said, "I'm not from around here. I'm from Detroit. I got a shoe store in Eastland Shopping Center. I'm here for a convention, see? If my wife hears about this on the radio, she's going to worry herself sick."
Sister Creep grunted in reply. Her mind was on finding water.
"The name's Wisco," he told her. "Arthur Wisco. Artie, for short. I gotta find a phone. See, I lost my wallet and my clothes and every damn thing. Me and some of the boys stayed out late the night before it happened. I was up chucking all over the place that morning, missed my first two sales meetings and stayed in bed. I had the covers over my head, and all of a sudden there was a god-awful light and a roaring, and my bed fell right through the floor. Hell, the whole hotel started shaking to pieces, and I crashed through a hole in the lobby and ended up in the basement, still in my bed. But when I dug myself out of there, the hotel was gone."
He gave a crazy little giggle.
"Jesus, the whole block was gone."
"A lot of blocks are gone."
"Yeah, well, my feet were cut up pretty bad. How about that? Me, Artie Wisco, with no shoes on my feet. So I had to take a pair of shoes off of... up."
He trailed off again. They climbed nearer to the top of the ridge.
"Bastards are way too small," he said. "But my feet are swollen up, too. I tell you, shoes are important. Where would people be without shoes? Now, take those sneakers you got on. They're cheap, and they ain't gonna last you very...
Sister Creep turned toward him. Will you shut up? She demanded. And then she kept climbing. He lasted about 40 seconds.
My wife said I shouldn't come on this trip, said I'd regret spending the money. I'm not a rich man. But I said, hell, it's once a year in a Big Apple, ain't too...
Everything's gone, Sister Creep screamed at him. You crazy fool! Look around!
Artie stood motionless, staring at her. And when he opened his mouth again, his tight, strained face looked about to rip.
Please, he whispered. Please don't.
The guy is hanging on by his fingernails, she realized. There was no need to chop his fingers off. She shook her head. The important thing was to keep from falling to pieces. Everything was gone, but she still had a choice. She could either sit down here in the rubble and wait to die, or she could find that water.
Sorry, she said. I didn't sleep too well last night.
His expression slowly began to register life again.
It's getting cold, he observed. Look, I can see my breath.
He exhaled ghostly air.
Here, you need this more than I do.
He started to take his mink coat off.
Listen, if my wife ever finds out I was wearing a mink, I'll never get off the hook.
She waved the coat away when he offered it, but Artie persisted.
Hey, don't worry. There are plenty where this one came from.
Finally, just to get them moving once more, Sister Creep let him put the tattered coat on her, and she ran her hand across the scorched mink.
My wife says I can be a real gentleman when I want to be, Artie told her. Hey, what happened to your neck?
Sister Creep touched her throat.
Somebody took something that belonged to me, she replied,
and then she clasped the mink coat around her shoulders to ward off the chill and continued climbing. It was the first time she'd ever worn mink. When she reached the top of the ridge, she had the wild urge to shout,
Hey, all you poor dead sinners, roll over and take a look at a lady.
The decimated city stretched out in all directions. Sister Creep started down the other side of the ridge, with Artie Wisco following close behind. He was still jabbering about Detroit and shoes and finding a phone, but Sister Creep tuned him out.
Show me the water, she told him when they reached the bottom.
He stood looking around for a minute, as if trying to decide where to grab a bus.
This way, he finally said.
And they had to climb again over the rough terrain of broken masonry, smashed cars, and twisted metal. So many corpses, in varying degrees of disfigurement, lay underfoot that Sister Creep stopped flinching when she stepped on one. At the top, Artie pointed.
There it is!
Down in the valley of wreckage below was a fountain of water spewing up from a fissure in the concrete. In the sky to the east, a network of red lightning streaks shot through the clouds, followed by a dull, reverberating explosion. They descended into the valley and walked over piles of what had been civilization's treasures 2 days before. Burned paintings still in their gilded frames, half-melted television sets and stereos, the mangled remains of sterling silver and gold punch bowls, cups, knives and forks, candelabras, music boxes, and champagne buckets, shards of what had been priceless pottery, antique vases, Art Deco statues, African sculpture, and Waterford crystal. The lightning flashed again, nearer this time, and the red glow sparkled off thousands of bits of jewelry scattered in the wreckage, necklaces and bracelets, rings and pins. She found a sign sticking up from the debris, and she almost laughed. But she feared that if she started, she might laugh on until her brains burst. The sign said, Fifth Avenue.
See?
Artie held up mink coats in both hands.
I told you there were more.
He was standing knee-deep in blackened finery. Leopard-skin cloaks, ermine robes, sealskin jackets.
He chose the best coat he could find and shrugged painfully into it. Sister Creep paused to poke through a pile of leather bags and briefcases. She found a large bag with a good solid strap and slipped it over her shoulder. Now she no longer felt quite as naked. She looked up at the black facade of the building that the leather items had blown out of, and she could just make out the remnants of the sign, Gucci. It was probably the best bag she'd ever had. They were almost to the geyser of water when a flash of lightning made things on the ground glint like embers. Sister Creep stopped, leaned down, and picked up one of them. It was a piece of glass the size of her fist. It had been melted into a lump, and embedded in it was a scatter of small jewels, rubies burning dark red in the gloom. She looked around herself and saw that the lumps of glass lay everywhere in the debris, all of them formed into strange shapes by the heat, as if fashioned by a maniacal glassblower. There was nothing left of the building that stood before her but a fragment of green marble wall. But she looked to the ruins of the structures that stood off to the left, and she squinted to see through the twilight. On an arch of battered marble were letters. T-I-F-A-N-Y. Tiffany's, Sister Creep realized. And if that was where Tiffany's had been, then she was standing right in front of... Oh, no, she whispered as tears sprang to her eyes. Oh, no. Oh, no. She was standing in front of what had been her magic place, the Steuben Glass Shop, and all that remained of the beautiful sculptured treasures were the misshapen lumps at her feet, the place where she'd come to dream at the displays of cool glass was gone, ripped from its foundations and scattered. The sight of this waste against the memory of what had been was as nerve-shattering as if the door of heaven had been slammed shut in her face. She stood motionless, except for the tears crawling over her blistered cheeks.
"Look at this," Artie called.
He picked up a deformed octagon of glass full of diamonds, rubies, and sapphires.
"Have you ever seen anything like this before? Look, they're all over the damned place."
He reached into the debris and brought up handfuls of melted glass studded with precious jewels.
"Hey!"
He laughed like the bray of a mule.
"We're rich, lady. What are we going to buy first?"
Still laughing, he threw the pieces of glass into the air.
"Anything you want, lady," he shouted. "I'll buy anything you want."
The lightning flashed, streaked across the sky, and Sister Creep saw the entire remaining wall of the Steuben Glass Shop explode in dazzling bursts of color. Ruby red, deep emerald, midnight sapphire blue, smoky topaz, and diamond white. She approached the wall, her shoes crunching on grit, reached out and touched it. The wall was full of jewels, and Sister Creep realized that the treasures of Tiffany's, Fortunoff's, and Cartier's must have blown out of the buildings, whirled in a fantastic hurricane of gemstones along Fifth Avenue and mingled with the melting glass sculptures of the magic place. The hundreds of jewels in the scorched green marble wall held the light for a few seconds, and then the glow faded like multicolored lamps going out.
Oh, the waste, she thought. Oh, the awful, awful waste.
She stepped back, her eyes stinging with tears, and one foot slipped on loose glass. She went down on her rear end and sat there, with no more will to get up again.
"You okay?" Artie walked carefully toward her. "Did you hurt yourself, lady?"
She didn't answer. She was tired and used up, and she decided she was going to stay right there in the ruins of the magic place and maybe rest for a while.
"Aren't you gonna get up? The water's just over there."
"Leave me alone," she told him listlessly. "Go away."
"Go away, lady? Where the hell am I gonna go?"
"I don't care. I don't give a shit. Not a single rotten shit."
She picked up a handful of melted glass and ashes and let the mess fall through her fingers. What was the use of taking one more step? The little man was right. There was nowhere to go. Everything was gone, burned and ruined.
"No hope," she whispered,
and she dug her hand deeply into the ashes beside her.
"No hope."
Her fingers closed around more junk glass, and she brought it up to see what kind of garbage her dreams had been twisted into.
"What the hell is that?" Artie asked.
In Sister Creep's hand was a donut-shaped ring of glass with a hole at its center, about 6 or 7 inches around. The ring itself was about 2 inches thick and maybe 7 inches in diameter. Jutting up around the top of the ring at irregular intervals were 5 glass spikes. One ice-pick thin, a second about as wide as a knife blade, a third hooked, and the other two just plain ugly. Trapped within the glass were hundreds of various-sized dark ovals and squares, strange spider-web lines interconnected deep within the glass.
"It's shit," she muttered,
and she started to toss it back on the trash heap when the lightning flashed again. The ring of glass suddenly exploded into fiery light, and for an instant Sister Creep thought it had burst into flame in her hand. She howled and dropped it, and Artie yelled, "Jesus!" The light went out. Sister Creep's hand was trembling. She looked at her palm and fingers to make sure she hadn't been burned. There'd been no heat, just that blinding flare of light. She could still see it pulsing behind her eyeballs. She reached toward it, then pulled her hand back again. Artie came closer and bent down a few feet away. Sister Creep let her fingers graze the glass before she jerked her hand away once more. The glass was smooth, like cool velvet. She let her fingers linger on it, and then she gripped it in her hand and picked it up from the ashes. The circle of glass remained dark. Sister Creep stared at it and felt her heart pounding. Deep within the glass circle, there was a flicker of crimson. It began to grow like a flame, to spread to other points within the ring, pulsing, pulsing, getting stronger and brighter by the second. A ruby the size of Sister Creep's thumbnail flared bright red. Another smaller one winked with light, like a match glowing in the dark. A third ruby burned like a comet. And then a fourth and a fifth, embedded deep inside the cool glass, began to come to life. The red glow pulsed, pulsed, and Sister realized its rhythm was in time with her own heartbeat. More rubies glinted, flared, burned like coals. A diamond suddenly glowed a clear blue-white, and a 4-carat sapphire exploded into dazzling cobalt fire. As Sister Creep's heartbeat quickened, so did the bursting into light of the hundreds of jewels trapped within the circle of glass. An emerald glowed cool green, a pear-shaped diamond burned white-hot and incandescent, a topaz pulsed a dark reddish-brown, and now the rubies, sapphires, diamonds, and emeralds by the dozens were awakening with light. The light rippled, traveling along the spider-web lines that wove all through the glass. The lines were threads of precious metals, gold, silver, and platinum, that had melted and been trapped as well. And as they ignited like sizzling fuses, they set off still more explosions of emerald, topaz, and amethysts deep purple. The entire ring of glass glowed like a multicolored circle of fire, yet there was no heat under Sister Creep's fingers. It was pulsating rapidly now, as was her heartbeat, and the vibrant, stunning colors grew still brighter. She had never seen anything like this, never, not even in the display windows of any store along Fifth Avenue. Jewels of incredible color and clarity were caught within the glass, some of them upwards of 5 and 6 carats, some only tiny specks but nevertheless burned with ferocious energy. The glass circle pulsed, pulsed, pulsed.
"Lady," Artie whispered, his swollen eyes shining with light, "can I hold it?"
She was reluctant to give it up, but he stared at it with such wonder and longing that she couldn't refuse him. His burned fingers closed around it, and as it left Sister Creep's grasp, the glass circle's pulse changed, picking up Artie Wisco's heartbeat. The colors subtly changed as well, as more deep blues and greens swelled, and the white-hot glare of diamonds and rubies faded a fraction. Artie caressed it, and its velvety surface reminded him of the way his wife's skin had felt when she was young and they were newlyweds, just starting out. He thought of how much he loved his wife and how he longed for her. He had been wrong, he realized in that instant. There was somewhere to go. Home, he thought. I've got to get back home. After a few minutes, he carefully gave the object back to Sister Creep. It changed again, and she sat holding it between her hands and peering into its beautiful depths.
Home,
Artie whispered, and the woman looked up. Artie's mind wouldn't let go of the memory of his wife's soft skin.
I've got to get back home, he said, his voice getting stronger.
He suddenly blinked as if he'd been slapped across the face, and Sister Creep saw tears glint in his eyes.
There ain't no more phones.
Arthur, he asked, and no policemen either.
No, she said, I don't think so.
Oh, he nodded, looked at her, and then back at the pulsating colors. You ought to go home, too, he said.
She smiled grimly.
I don't have anywhere to go.
Why don't you go with me, then?
She laughed.
Go with you? Mister, haven't you noticed the buses and cabs are a little off schedule today?
I've got shoes on my feet. So do you. My legs still work, and yours do, too.
He pulled his gaze away from the ring of fiery light and peered around at the destruction as if seeing it clearly for the first time.
Dear God, he said. Oh, dear God, why?
I don't think God had much to do with this, Sister Creep said. I remember I prayed for the rapture and I prayed for Judgment Day, but I never prayed for anything like this, never.
Artie nodded toward the glass ring.
You ought to hold on to that thing, lady. You found it, so I guess it's yours. It might be worth something someday.
He shook his head in awe.
That's not junk, lady, he said. I don't know what it is, but it's sure not junk.
He suddenly stood up and lifted the collar of his mink coat around his neck.
Well, I hope you make it out okay, lady.
With one last longing gaze at the glass ring, he turned and started walking.
Hey,
Sister stood up too. Where do you think you're going?
I told you, he replied without looking back. I gotta get home.
Are you crazy? Detroit's not just around the block.
He didn't stop. He's nuts, she thought. Crazier than I am. She put the circle of glass into her new Gucci bag, and as she took her hand away from it, the pulsing ceased and the colors instantly faded, as if the thing were going to sleep again. She walked after Artie.
Hey, wait! What are you gonna do about food and water?
I guess I'll find it when I need it. If I can't find it, I'll do without. What choice do I have, lady?
Not much, she agreed.
He stopped and faced her.
Right. Hell, I don't know if I'll get there. I don't even know if I'll get out of this damn junkyard. But this ain't my home. If a person's gotta die, he oughta die trying to go home to somebody he loves, don't you think?
He shrugged.
Maybe I'll find some more people. Maybe I'll find a car. If you want to stay here, that's your business. But Artie Wisco's got shoes on his feet, and Artie Wisco's walking.
He waved and started off again.
He's not crazy anymore, she thought.
A cold rain began falling, the drops black and oily. Sister Creep opened her bag again and touched the misshapen glass circle with one finger to see what would happen. A single sapphire blazed to life, and she was reminded of the spinning blue light flashing in her face. A memory was close, very close, but before she could grasp it, it had streaked away again. It was something she knew that she wasn't yet ready to remember. She lifted her finger, and the sapphire went dark. One step, she told herself, one step, and then the next gets you where you're going. But what if you don't know where to go?
Hey, she shouted at Artie, at least look for an umbrella, and try to find a bag like this one I've got, so you can put food and stuff in it.
Christ, she thought, this guy wouldn't make it a mile. She ought to go with him, she decided, if only to keep him from breaking his neck.
Wait for me, she shouted,
and then she walked a few yards to the geyser of the broken water main and stood under it, letting the water wash the dust, ashes, and blood off her. She opened her mouth and drank until her stomach sloshed. Now hunger took thirst's place. Maybe she could find something to eat, and maybe not, she considered, but at least she was no longer thirsty. One step, she thought, one step at a time. Artie was waiting for her. Sister Creep's instincts caused her to gather up a few smaller chunks of glass with jewels embedded in them, and she wrapped them in a ragged blue scarf and put them into her Gucci bag. She nosed around the wreckage. A bag lady's paradise, and found a pretty jade box, but it played a tune when she lifted the lid, and the sweet music in the midst of so much death saddened her. She returned the box to the broken concrete. Then she started walking toward Artie Wisco through the chilly rain, and she left the ruins of the magic place behind. Chapter 17.
Gophers in the hole, Papa Briggs raved. Lord God, we come a cropper.
Josh Hutchins had no idea what time it was or how long they'd been there. He'd been sleeping a lot and having awful dreams about Rose and the boys running before a tornado of fire. He was amazed that he could still breathe. The air was stale, but it seemed okay. Josh expected to close his eyes very soon and not awaken again. The pain of his burns was bearable as long as he stayed still. He lay listening to the old man babble on, and Josh thought that suffocating probably wouldn't be such a bad way to die. Maybe it was only like getting the hiccups just before you went to sleep, and you weren't really aware that your lungs were hitching for oxygen. He felt sorriest for the little girl. So young, he thought, so young. Didn't even have a chance to grow up. Well, he decided, I'm going back to sleep now. Maybe this would be the last time. He thought of those people in the wrestling arena at Concordia, and wondered how many of them were dead or dying right now, this minute. Poor Johnny Lee Richwine, busted leg one day and this the next. Shit. It's not fair. Not fair at all. Something tugged at his shirt. The movement sent little panics of pain shooting through his nerves.
Mister?
Swan asked. She'd heard his breathing and had crawled to him through the darkness.
Can you hear me, mister?
She tugged at his shirt again for good measure.
Yes, he answered. I can hear you. What is it?
My mama's sick. Can you help her?
Josh sat upright.
What's wrong with her?
She's breathing funny. Please, come help her.
The child's voice was strained, but she wasn't giving in to tears. Tough little kid, Josh thought.
Okay, now take my hand and lead me to her.
He held his hand out, and after a few seconds she found it in the darkness and clenched three of his fingers in her hand. Swan led him, both of them, crawling across the basement to where her mother lay in the dirt. Swan had been asleep, curled close to her mother, when she was awakened by a noise like the rasp of a rusted hinge. Her mother's body was hot and damp, but Darlene was shivering.
Mama, Swan whispered. Mama, I brought the giant to help you. I just need to rest, honey.
The voice was drowsy.
I'm okay, now don't you worry about me.
Are you hurting anywhere? Josh asked her.
Shit, fire. What a question. I'm hurting all over. Christ.
I don't know what hit me. I was feeling fine just a while ago, like I had a sunburn is all, but shit. I've had worse sunburns than this.
She swallowed thickly.
I sure could use a beer right now.
There might be something down here to drink.
Josh started searching, uncovering more dented cans. Without a light, though, he couldn't tell what they contained.
He was thirsty and hungry, too, and he knew the child must be. Pawpaw could surely use some water.
He found a can of something that had burst open and was leaking out. He tasted the liquid. Sugary peach juice, a can of peaches.
Here.
He held the can to the woman's mouth so she could drink. Darlene slurped at it, then pushed it weakly away.
What are you trying to do? Poison me? I said I need a beer.
Sorry, this is the best I can do for now.
He gave the can to Swan and told her to drink.
When are they coming to dig us out of this shithole?
Darlene asked.
I don't know. Maybe.
He paused.
Maybe soon.
Jesus. I feel like one side of me is being cooked and the other's in a deep freeze. It hit me all of a sudden.
You'll be all right, Josh said.
It was ridiculous, but he didn't know what else to say. He sensed the child close to him, silent and listening.
She knows, he thought. Just rest, and you'll get your strength back.
See, Swan, I told you I was going to be fine.
Josh could do nothing else. He took the can of peaches from Swan and crawled over to where Pawpaw lay raving.
Come on, Cropper, Pawpaw babbled. Oh, Lord, did you find the key? Now how am I going to start a truck without a key?
Josh put an arm under the old man's head, tilting it up, and then putting the broken can to his lips. Pawpaw was both shivering and burning up with fever.
Drink it,
Josh said, and the old man was as obedient as an infant with a bottle.
Mister, are we going to get out of here?
Josh hadn't realized the little girl was nearby. Her voice was still calm, and she was whispering so her mother couldn't hear.
Sure, he replied.
The child was silent, and again Josh had the feeling that even in the dark, she'd seen through his lie.
I don't know, he amended. Maybe, maybe not. It depends.
Depends on what?
Not going to let me off the hook, are you? He thought.
I guess it depends on what's left outside. Do you understand what's happened?
Something blew up, she answered.
Right. But a lot of other places might have blown up, too. Whole cities. There might be...
He hesitated. Go ahead and say it. You might as well get it out.
There might be millions of people dead or trapped, just like we are. So there might not be anybody left to get us out.
She paused for a moment, then she replied,
That's not what I asked. I asked, are we going to get out of here?
Josh realized she was asking if they were going to try to get themselves out, instead of waiting for someone else to come help them.
Well, he said, if we had a bulldozer handy, I'd say yes. Otherwise, I don't think we're going anywhere anytime soon.
My mama's real sick,
Swan said, and this time her voice cracked.
I'm afraid.
So am I, Josh admitted.
The little girl sobbed just once, and then she stopped as if she'd pulled herself together with tremendous willpower. Josh reached out and found her arm. Blisters broke on her skin. Josh flinched and withdrew his hand.
How about you? He asked her. Are you hurting?
My skin hurts. It feels like needles and pins in my stomach sick. I had to throw up a while ago, but I did it in the corner.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel kind of sick myself.
He felt a pressing need to urinate as well, and he was going to have to figure out a makeshift sanitation system. They had plenty of canned food and fruit juices, and no telling what else was buried around them in the dirt. Stop it, he thought, because he'd allowed himself a flicker of hope. The air's going to be gone soon. There's no way we can survive down here. But he knew also they were in the only place that could have sheltered them from the blast. With all that dirt above them, the radiation might not get through. Josh was tired and his bones ached, but he no longer felt the urge to lie down and die. If he did, he thought, the little girl's fate would be sealed too. But if he fought off the weariness and got to work organizing the cans of food, he might be able to keep them all alive for... how long, he wondered. One more day, three more, a week. How old are you? He asked.
I'm 9, she answered.
9, he repeated softly, and he shook his head. Rage and pity warred in his soul. A 9-year-old child ought to be playing in the summer sun. A 9-year-old child shouldn't be down in a dark basement with 1 foot in the grave. It wasn't fair, damn it, to hell, it wasn't right.
What's your name?
It was a minute before he could find his voice.
Josh. And yours is Swan?
Sue Wanda, but my mama calls me Swan. How'd you get to be a giant?
There were tears in his eyes, but he smiled anyway.
I guess I ate my mama's cornbread when I was about your age.
Cornbread made you a giant?
Well, I was always big. I used to play some football, first at Auburn University, then for the New Orleans Saints.
Do you still?
Nope. I was a wrestler, he said. Professional wrestling. I was the bad guy.
Oh,
Swan thought about that. She recalled that one of her many uncles, Uncle Chuck, used to like to go to the wrestling matches in Wichita and watch them on TV, too.
Did you like that, being the bad guy, I mean?
It's kind of a game, really. I just acted bad. And I don't know if I liked it or not. It was just something I started to do.
Gophers in the hole,
Papa said.
Lordy, look at him go.
Why does he keep talking about a gopher?
Swan asked.
He's hurt. He doesn't know what he's saying.
Papa rambled on about finding his bedroom slippers and something about the crops needing rain. Then he lapsed again into silence. Heat radiated off the old man's body, as if from an open oven, and Josh knew he couldn't last much longer. God only knew what looking into that blast had done inside his skull.
Mama said we were going to Blakeman,
Swan said, pulling her attention away from the old man. She knew he was dying.
She said we were going home. Where were you going?
Garden City. I was supposed to wrestle there.
Is that your home?
No. My home's down in Alabama, a long, long way from here.
Mama said we were going to see my granddaddy. He lives in Blakeman. Does your family live in Alabama?
He thought of Rose and his 2 sons, but they were part of someone else's life now, if indeed they were still alive.
I don't have any family, Josh replied.
Don't you have anybody who loves you?
Swan asked.
No, he said. I don't think so.
He heard Darlene moan, and he said, You better see to your mother, huh?
Yes, sir.
Swan started to crawl away, but then she looked back into the darkness where the black giant was.
I knew something terrible was going to happen, she said. I knew it the night we left Uncle Tommy's trailer. I tried to tell my mama, but she didn't understand.
How did you know?
The fireflies told me. She said, I saw it in their lights. Sue Wanda,
Darlene called weakly.
Swan, where are you?
Swan said,
Here, Mama.
And she crawled back to her mother's side.
The fireflies told her, Josh thought. Right. Yeah, at least the little girl had a strong imagination, and that was good. Sometimes the imagination could be a useful place to hide in when the going got rough.
But he suddenly remembered the cloud of locusts that had flown through his car. Been flying out of the fields by the thousands for the last 2-3 days, Papa had told him. Kinda peculiar. Had the locusts known something was about to happen in those cornfields? Josh wondered. Had they been able to sense disaster, maybe smell it on the wind?